This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, may peace be upon you all. I praise Allah, I begin in his name and I send peace and salutations upon the Prophet, peace be upon him. On behalf of Lancaster University's Islamic Society, I'd like to welcome you all and thank, for those of you who are here, thank you for being here today and really thank the speaker who's come all the way from London to deliver the speech today. My name is Ayaz Khalid and I will be your host for today's event. Before I do introduce the speaker, I just want to highlight the format of tonight's event. There'll be a 40 to 45 minute speech, after which there'll be a question and answer session for 15 to 20 minutes. After this, there'll be enough time outside to socialize as well as to eat. The hot snacks are provided, as well as take some free literature, which is also going to be available outside. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Brother Abdullah Al-Andalusi. Abdullah Al-Andalusi was a former Christian of Portuguese descent who embraced Islam at a very young age and has studied Islam in depth ever since. He has long experience of working in the Muslim community and has activities involving writing, talking extensively in Islamic revivalism, philosophy, sociology and anthropology. Abdullah has delivered talks throughout the UK. He's delivered them in universities, in colleges, as well as Islamic centres, and he has also appeared on various TV programmes too. He has also engaged in a number of discussions with atheists, humanists, secularists, Christians on a variety of topics, and he is a member of the Muslim Debate Initiative, a public discussion forum that promotes open dialogue and debate. I'd like to welcome Brother Abdullah Al-Andalusi for an insightful event.
Thank you for that introduction, and thank you for everyone attending. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen, As-Salaatu As-Salaam, Nabi Muhammad ala alihi tayyibin wa sahbihi as-Salihin. Today's talk is Sharia Inhumane? It's a very interesting title, and the reason why is because every day the media and newspapers and TV programs and movies portray Sharia and Islam as being inhumane. While they are forced by the liberal, I guess you could say, agenda to respect Islam, its spiritual traditions as a religion, it also, at the same time, condemns any aspects of Islam which is contrary to liberalism in the political, legal aspects. But I want to answer this question properly and thoroughly, and so to do so, I'm going to bring some dictionary definitions. What does it mean to be inhumane? According to the Oxford English Dictionary, it is without compassion for misery or suffering and being cruel. Compassion is defined in the Oxford English Dictionary as sympathetic pity and concern for the sufferings or misfortunes of others. But the common misconceived view about the Sharia is that it is specifically inhumane to three general categories: women, non-Muslims, and sinners. When I mean by sinners, I refer to thieves, fornicators and adulterers, and homosexuals. And so it is perceived that Islam is inhumane to these main groups of people. So to assess this, I will use two simple criteria. Is the Sharia inhumane or anti-human? And what does this mean? Does the Sharia not allow human beings to fulfill their natural needs, to achieve a natural fulfillment? And the second criteria is, does the Sharia show compassion? Before we apply these criteria, let me discuss something more fundamental, something which is the justifying principle and underlying framework to any system. How do we view human beings? First, let's take liberalism, the prevailing ideology in the Western world. Liberalists like to consider their ideology to be the benchmark of humane values, and anything that does not resemble liberalism is called inhumane. But let's take a closer look at liberalism. Liberalism starts off with a premise of rights, that humans have a set of rights. But where do these rights come from? Who determines what rights humans have? How are these rights mystically assigned to humans, and where is justification to this? If you were on a desert island surrounded by natural predators, would they respect your rights? Does evolution respect the rights of living things? Just because something exists doesn't mean it naturally has rights. Like this chair exists. Does this chair have rights just because it exists? The philosopher Charles Taylor said, "The very idea of starting an argument whose foundation was the rights of the individual would have been strange and puzzling. Why do we begin to find it reasonable to start a political theory with an assertion of human rights and giving it primacy?" Islam views human beings differently. Islam starts on the premise of purpose, that man's purpose is to worship God and to submit to the natural law governing our creation. Because everything in the universe has a natural law. If you study physics, you'll look at the natural law of various inanimate objects, things, energies, and forces. So the purpose of our existence is to submit to the natural law for our creation as part of this universe. Thus, human beings begin with duties. Because it is only through the existence of duties as a prerequisite that rights come into being. So if it is my duty to look after you, to take care of you, or to protect you, then you then will have the right for security, the right for preservation of life, because I am going to protect you. That is will be my duty, for example. And the Quran says, "O mankind, remain conscious of your duty to your Lord, who created you of a single soul, and of like nature created its mate, and from the pair of them created and spread many women and men." Now, rights aside, liberalism posits a strange and irrational conception for human purpose. It starts by ignoring any higher purpose or mechanism that brought human beings into existence, and instead focuses merely on a superficial explanation of our existence. Liberalism says that the purpose of human life is just sensual gratification, or in the common euphemism, to seek happiness. But our physiologies and our instincts beg to differ. Our brain rewards us for achieving goals related to survival, moral, or reproduction by releasing chemicals that are pleasurable once we attain these objectives. But our brain does not release these chemicals for us doing nothing or just existing. In essence, our body is pushing us to do things for a higher goal than just enjoying the ride. As a friend of mine put it, we eat to live, not live to eat. In contrast, Islam believes that creation has a purpose, and humans hold a purpose within that creation. The Quran says, "And we did not create the heaven and the earth and that which is between them aimlessly." This is the assumption of those who disbelieve, so woe to those who disbelieve. Furthermore, liberalism's unjustified notions of human entitlement, together with making sacred the tyranny of the ego, one's arbitrary whims and desires, married to a self-centered perspective to the world, has caused great evil, as the strong compete against the weak with no regard for the consequences to other people or other nations' ability to provide for their population, and now even the environment is suffering. As Professor Daniel Bell, lecturer in political science at the University of Singapore, says, "Liberalism, it is claimed, contributes to, or at least does not sufficiently take account of, the negative social and psychological effects related to the atomistic tendencies of modern liberal societies. There is undoubtedly a worrying trend in contemporary societies towards a callous individualism that ignores community and social obligations, and liberal theory does not seem up to the task of dealing with this problem." Islam knows that human impulses, if you unleash them, they are insatiable. The Prophet Muhammad said, "If the son of Adam was to be given a valley, two valleys filled with gold, he would want a third one." So having a law that treats people equally, regardless of their specific needs or abilities, and granting unrestricted liberty to a society which people are possessed of natural advantages. For example, some people might have good looks, some people might have intelligence, others might have wealth, others might have charisma, and some might have influence. These people can leverage these advantages to exploit the people who do not have these advantages in that society, and hence, the strong will then exploit the weak in every sphere. As the Swiss philosopher, poet, and critic Henri-Frédéric Amiel said, "Liberty, equality, bad principles. The only true principle for mankind is justice, and justice to the feeble is protection and kindness." Islam prescribes morality and justice as its main focus. The Quran tells us, "We have sent our messengers with clear signs and sent that with them the book and the measure in order to establish justice among the people." Islam understands that human beings are not iron-willed moral heroes, and so does not hold human beings to unrealistically high standards of conduct. Islam does not allow alcohol, but then prosecute people who do bad things while they're drunk. Islam does not condone exploiting women's sexuality to sell products, but then condemns men for womanizing and infidelity. Islam does not advocate unrestricted amassing of wealth, but then condemns bankers for not caring about the poor who suffer from the economic fallout. Liberalism does. And then it wonders why crime rates are so high, why there is economic inequality, and why 1 in 4 women have reported sexual rape or attempted sexual rape in both America and UK. And I got those statistics from Rape Crisis UK. Humans are capable of noble and righteous actions, but they are also fallible and weak. They can act irrationally, are easily influenced by their social and economic environment. They generally can succumb to a variety of temptations like cheating on one's spouse, smoking addiction, unhealthy eating addiction, alcohol addiction, womanizing, being distracted by various forms of media, greed, pride, etc., etc. Thus, Islam aims to tackle these sources of man's weakness and promote more positive satisfactions for human impulses. And more importantly, it does not expect superhuman standards of conduct. It tries to be realistic when organizing humans. The Quran tells us, "Allah would make the burden light for you, for man was created weak." The Prophet Muhammad said, "I have been sent with an easy and practicable Sharia." And in this context, Sharia means law. The Sharia aims to protect and liberate human beings from base desires to enable them to fully realize themselves without hampering the rights of others. In the ayah of the Quran, it says, "Those who follow the messenger, who enjoins upon them that which is right and forbids them which is wrong, he will make lawful for them all the good things and prohibit for them all the bad things. And he will relieve them of their burdens and the fetters which they used to wear." So Islam aims to liberate human beings from self-destructive conduct and mutually destructive conduct in society. And harm isn't only physical harm. People think that what's the problem if you allow freedom for everyone as long as you don't physically harm each other? That would be fine if every human being was an island unto themselves emotionally. But you can emotionally harm people. You can stop them from achieving their goals. You can make them depressed. You can make them incur emotional pain, which is greater than physical pain. So Islam does not deny natural human fulfillment. It seeks to facilitate and liberate it. Sharia organizes human beings so that they don't act to impinge each other's rights. However, it encourages and leaves unrestricted the positive ways of fulfillment. For example, Islam prohibits fornication and adultery, but it encourages marriage. Islam prohibits interest, but encourages trade and investment. Islam prohibits sexual exploitation and public immodesty, but encourages beautification, romance, and sexual satisfaction inside the marriage for both men and women. Human beings are weak, so the Sharia helps to remove public temptations and promote positive reinforcement. And I'll give you an example. The Prophet Muhammad said that he was speaking to men, that if any man sees a woman that charms him, go back home to your wife. She has the like of it. She has the same thing. So deny doing something wrong, which is cheating on your wife, and go back home to your wife and fulfill your desire with her, this is positive reinforcement. So, the first criteria, is the Sharia inhuman or anti-human? I.e., does it allow human beings to achieve natural fulfillment? Well, let's discuss the first category I mentioned, women. Is the Sharia inhumane to women? Firstly, in Islam, men and women are viewed as fundamentally equal. In the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, I do not waste the deed of any doer among you, be they male or female, the one of you is as the other. Secondly, as individuals, Islam gave women the right to own property when they had no right. And it was only recently, I think, within the last century, that women in this country had the right to own property. The second thing, women have the right to keep her property after marriage and not give the husband any of it. They have the right to be given a marriage gift, usually a considerable sum of money in some cases. And if divorced, they have to receive alimony. Women have the right to vote. The Prophet Muhammad ﷺ requested the Pledge of Allegiance for his leadership from women and was not only satisfied to receive it from men. Women have the right to work and own a business. The Prophet's wife, Khadija رضي الله عنها, was a successful businesswoman. Women have the right to an education. Women have a right to choose who they marry. The Prophet Muhammad ﷺ annulled a marriage of a woman who was forced to get married to a man by her father. But because she liked that man after the marriage, she said, no, don't annul it. I just came here on principle to see that being forced for marriage is not the Islamic way. Women have the right for sexual satisfaction in marriage. The Prophet Muhammad ﷺ spoke to a guy and reprimanded him, a man who was outside of his house constantly, and said, go back home to your wife. She has a right upon you. The women in Islam have a right to affection and love in marriage, and they also have a right to dignity and respect, a right that's not given in the West. If you just listen to what couples who are arguing say to each other, both on soap opera TV and in real life, you'll see what I mean. And what I mean by dignity and respect is not being insulted or reviled or using bad names, but we all know what the names used for women in this society are, which you see on TV. Name, for example, like a female dog, for example, which they use to refer to women. And it's meant to be all jokey and fun, but then guys speak to each other with this name all the time. It's not acceptable. Muawiyah al-Kushayri narrated that he went to the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ and asked him, what do you command us about our wives? He replied, give them food from what you have for yourself, clothe them from what you clothe yourself, and do not beat them, and do not revile them, or do not insult them. Do not insult them. The Quran says, and among his signs is this, that he created for you wives from amongst yourselves, that ye may find repose in them. And he has put between you affection and mercy. Verily, in that are indeed signs for people who reflect. So the basis for marriage is affection and mercy. In a hadith, the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ ordered men, not one of you should fall upon his wife like an animal, but let there be first a messenger between you. And they asked, what is that messenger? And he replied, it is kisses and words. So don't just attack, so to speak, your wife sexually like an animal, but rather approach her with romance and gentleness. In fact, even the children of women in Islam are told to respect their mothers more than their fathers. A person came to the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ and asked, who amongst the people is most deserving of my fine treatment? He responded, your mother. And then he asked, and then who? And the Prophet said, your mother. Again, and then who? Your mother. And then who? Then your father. So women are held in very high esteem in Islam. And I think a confusion arises regarding the issue of equality, because in liberalism it's assumed that if you're equal, then the law should treat you absolutely the same. But liberalism is not even consistent on that, because if someone is handicapped or disabled, they have extra privileges to compensate for them being handicapped or disabled, which the law gives them, disabled people, which you don't get. So the law treats people who are different differently, even in liberalism. Yet when Islam does so, it is reviled as being unequal and rendering women as second-class citizens. But I'll explain what Islam does regards women and men. Islam is functionalist. And basically, if you have different abilities, then you have different responsibilities. So if you can give birth to a child, then you have different responsibility to a man who can't give birth to a child and doesn't have to carry a child inside him for 9 months and bear the pains of birth and child rearing. So Islam recognizes that the difference between men and women, I know it sounds obvious, but it is the case. And the basic social unit in Islam is the family. In liberalism, it's the individual. And herein lies the problem. And in communism, it's society. Society is just one whole. But we're not discussing communism here today. In Islam, the basic reproductive unit and first support mechanism is the family. Individuals are born into a family, not the other way around. If society doesn't help you, your family will. Therefore, the family has to be the bedrock of society. So the family structure is organized like this. Men, who nature has made physically stronger, taller and bigger, are the maintainers and protectors of women. In the Quran it says, and women shall have rights similar to the rights against them according to what is equitable. But men have a degree of responsibility over them, and Allah is exalted in power and wise. It's funny because in nature, what we see in nature is if different animals, if there's difference between the gender, for example, let's say ants, for example. Ants, the queen, obviously she is the basis of the entire nest. But you have specialized worker ants and specialized soldier ants. And these ants have to do special tasks because the soldier ant has bigger claw mandibles, so he can obviously attack threats and dangers. And the workers, obviously, they work and they can't reproduce in most species of ants. So they all rely on the queen to be the base of the nest. So is ant society unequal? Should we be campaigning for ant rights? No, this is how nature organizes creatures. And we are creatures, we are part of nature. So why can't we admit the functionalism in our own species? In the West, the concept of equality is for women to resemble what a man considers to be successful, i.e. having a high-flying career. But who says a career is better than motherhood? Does maintaining a high-flying career equate in importance to nurturing and giving birth, literally, to the future of the human race? Which one is more important, having a job or a future for the human species? The Islamic social system is designed such that a woman should never have to worry about their upkeep and protection of her person or her children. She is always guaranteed a guardian. A man is not. Men are obligated in Islam to spend their wealth on the upkeep of women. Women do not have to spend a single dinar of their wealth on men. This is also why you see men having more inheritance than women, because men have to spend that inheritance on providing and feeding for their family, whereas women don't have any obligations where to spend their money. Women are entitled to alimony after divorce, but men are not. In Islam and in the natural world, functional specialization, as I said, does not mean inequality. It means that what is different amongst us be used to best help others. So, men are physically stronger, have high endurance for physical work, and can run 10% faster. Women are not able to achieve the same sporting records that men achieve in like-for-like activities. Men are specialized for competition, physical work, and fighting. Thus, Islam seems to employ men solely to defend, maintain, perpetuate, and improve the living conditions of women. So in essence, us guys, we are literally the worker and soldier ants, and our whole life actually orbits around the women of our families. And that's basically what the purpose of men. It's just basically to provide for and take care and look after women. Some could say that Islam is unfair on men now. And maybe in my next talk, I have to call for men's rights in Islam. But Islam has liberated women basically to be women and not have to worry about mundane things like where their next meal is coming from or feeling insecure to possible threats in society like rapists or murderers. A woman's choice to work is now one that she can make at leisure, not out of necessity. The true reality of Islam is men and women need each other. And in Islam, there is no battle of the sexes like in the West. but rather men and women are viewed as allies and helpers to each other. In the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us, and the believers, men and women, are friends one of the other. They enjoin what is right and forbid what is wrong. And they establish worship and pay charity, and they obey God and His Messenger. As for these, God will grant mercy on them. Now, I think the next section is quite an interesting one, because there is a lot of misconceptions about this. Is the Sharia inhumane to non-Muslims? Well, firstly, non-Muslims living in an Islamic state, unfortunately of which there is none in current existence, are not compelled to become Muslim. The Quran says, and everyone knows this, there is no compulsion in religion, truth stands out clear from error. So because we are so confident of the truth, there is no compulsion in religion. The Prophet Muhammad ﷺ encountered a delegation of Christians from St. Catherine's Monastery in the Sinai. And they basically asked to be incorporated into the Islamic polity. And here is the agreement that the Prophet Muhammad made with them for how they should live as citizens in the Islamic system. This is the message from Muhammad ibn Abdullah, which is the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ's name, as a covenant to those who adopt Christianity near and far. We are with them. Verily I, the servants, the helpers, and my followers defend them because Christians are my citizens. And by Allah, I hold out against anything that displeases them. No compulsion is to be upon them. Neither are their judges to be removed from their jobs, nor their monks from their monasteries. No one is to destroy a house of their religion, to damage it, or to carry anything from it to a Muslim house. Should anyone take any of these, he would spoil God's covenant and disobey his prophet. Verily, they are my allies and have a secure charter against all that they hate. No one is to force them to travel or to oblige them to fight. The Muslims are to fight for them. If a female Christian is married to a Muslim, it is not to take place without her approval. She is not to be prevented from visiting her church to pray. Their churches are to be respected. They are neither to be prevented from repairing them, nor the sacredness of their convents. No one of the nation of Muslims is to disobey this covenant until the last day, i.e. the end of the world. The Prophet Muhammad also said, whoever oppresses a person under covenant, which is basically a non-Muslim citizen, or oppresses him, or imposes on him something more than he can afford, or humiliates him, or takes anything from him without his consent, I will oppose him on the Day of Judgment. And I imagine the horror in the mind of the Muslim to know that if you did something, the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ would oppose you himself on the Day of Judgment, indicating it is forbidden for us to oppress, impose, or even humiliate, not even allowed to insult a non-Muslim in living in a Muslim land. You don't get that kind of rights and freedoms in this country. So non-Muslims are allowed, if you notice, their judges not to be removed in that covenant. Non-Muslims are allowed their own law systems. As the Sharia does not believe in one law for all, why should people who don't believe in your beliefs be forced to live under your religious laws? That's not fair. Henrik Greitz, a 19th century Jewish historian, expressed how Islamic rule in Spain favored the Jews in the context of kindness and liberty of belief. He says, "It was in these favorable circumstances that the Spanish Jews came under the rule of the Mahometans," which is the word for Muslims, "as whose allies they esteemed themselves the equals of their co-religionists. In Babylonia and Persia, they were kindly treated, obtained religious liberty of which they had been so long deprived. They were permitted to exercise jurisdiction over their fellow co-religionists and were only obliged, like the conquered Christians, to pay a tax for citizenship." In summary, your rights as a non-Muslim citizen are as follows. You have the right to believe what you want. You have the right to live under your own religious laws, even in your own communities, which according to Islamic sources seems to possess a degree of autonomy, which is more than can be said for secular countries. You have the right to representation in the People's Parliament, otherwise known as the Majlis al-Ummah. You have the right to express your beliefs and challenge Muslim beliefs in public debate. Like, for example, the Christians of Najran, who came to the Prophet Muhammad's mosque, met the Prophet, debated him, denied him as being a prophet, prayed the Christian prayers in the mosque, and then left back to Najran, and there was no problem. You have the right to be protected by Muslim armies who will fight to the death to protect you. In return, all that is required is a tax for citizenship that helps support these armies. If you choose to participate in military service, which all Muslim males have to do, your citizenship tax is waived. Like the tribe of Al-Jurajima, which was a Christian tribe that lived outside Antioch, they said, we don't want to pay the citizen tax, we'll actually participate in military fighting like Muslim males are. And they said, that's fine, then your tax is waived. If you are a woman or child, you do not pay citizenship tax. Citizenship tax is an exemption from military duty, which women and children are not obliged to perform. If you are poor, disabled, or old, you are entitled to state support from the treasury. We all know the story, the Muslims here, that Caliph Omar encountered an old Christian, a blind man or beggar. And as soon as he encountered this person, he said, how could we have taken your tax from you when you were younger and now leave you destitute? He was so abhorred about this, that this person was reduced to begging, that he took him to the treasury and said, you know, pay this man what he needs to basically live. So, i.e. a state grant. These are the rights that ensured Islam created a successful multicultural system that lasted centuries. In fact, I challenge anyone to find a country in the Western world that equals these rights. Are you tax exempt if you join the army? Are you allowed to your own religious laws and your own autonomous areas? No. In fact, they're saying that multiculturalism isn't working. So much for liberalism being pluralistic. The third category now, is Sharia inhumane to sinners? Is Sharia barbaric for people who basically break the law or break its statutes? The Sharia is not totalitarian. It does not regulate what you do in the privacy of your own home. The Quran says, O believers, do not enter other people's houses until other people's houses than your own until you have the approval of the inhabitants inside. And we wish them peace. This is the best way for you. It is expected that you will observe it. The purpose of the penal system in Islam is to only deter public acts of corruption, bad example, or temptation. The Sharia is not for regulating the piety of people in private sphere. That is between them and God. Islam is not here to make the Sharia is not here to make you a better Muslim in private. That's your duty. The penal system in Islam only has a handful of punishments which are capital offences. And as we know, capital punishment means execution. But Islam considers the alternative to capital punishment to be more barbaric. Locking people in cages like animals, where they are forced to do horrific things to each other to survive. And I won't even go into that because it's probably we're too young to know. And this Islam considers to be horrific. And people are saying, why are you sending someone to life in a cage? Why? That's inhumane. They're suffering. You now have prolonged their suffering. At least execution is very quick for people, who commit murder. And Islam is not the only one who said this. The famous liberal philosopher, John Stuart Mill, he said, if In our horror of inflicting death, we endeavour to devise some punishment for the living criminals, which shall act on the human mind with a deterrent force at all comparable to that of death, we are driven to inflictions less severe indeed in appearance, and therefore less efficacious, but far more cruel in reality. So even John Stuart Mill said this in favour of not abolishing the capital punishment in England, because in essence, in his entire discussion, he was saying that people are deterred by death penalty. If you remove it, then your prisons will be filled to overflowing. And it seems that his prediction has come true. British prisons are now filled to overflowing. And America, for example, has the highest prison population in the world, even beats China. Beats China. And China has much more bigger population, 1 billion people. So that's even more humiliating on America. The Sharia aims to maintain the protection of property, life, and the institution of marriage and family. In regards to this, the protection of property, it has a punishment for people who commit theft or they thief. And the punishment is amputation of the hand. Now, this has been portrayed as being very barbaric, but people don't understand the conditions. If a person steals because they are poor, there is no punishment. In fact, it's a shame on the state. The state should have been providing for the poor person. Why is he stealing? You have to steal from a secure location and take it by stealth, and the amount that you steal must be above one quarter of a gold coin in value, and you must steal from outside of your family. So basically, you have to go out of your way to steal. A man who goes out of his way to steal by stealth from a secure location, and he does it for pure luxury, not for poverty, he does it for luxury. Then Islam amputates the hand. And why does he amputate the hand? Because what do you steal with? What does a thief need? He needs his hands. So if a society that does not value material objects or commercialization as the primary goal of human life, and in a society whereby you are cared for, your family will be cared for as a bare minimum, the state will provide for you if you are poor, in that kind of society where virtue is promoted and self-interest is not the basis of human considerations, if you still steal despite all these conditions, all these environmental conditions, and you steal from a secure location from stealth above one quarter of the value of a gold coin, then there must be something wrong with you. Now, if you are insane, then you're not punished because an insane person can't be punished. They're not to blame. But if you're sane and you still do all this, then you are a danger to the economic system. And so the economic system must be protected, and you are denied the means to steal, which is i.e. the amputation of the hand. It's not for the gruesomeness of that punishment. It actually serves a functional purpose. Islam also believes in the protection of life. The punishment for murder, obviously, is execution. However, the family of the victim can choose to forgive the murderer and demand compensation for the murder. You don't get that in this society, the aspect of forgiveness. Also, and this is the main contention, adultery. The punishment for adultery in Islam is capital punishment, yes. However, what is the conditions? What is the conditions? You need in Islam four witnesses to the act of adultery. And it must be absolutely clear that there was sexual intercourse. Not just two bodies next to each other, but absolutely clear. I won't go into detail, but you can use your imaginations. Now, unless you're filming it in a football stadium with everyone watching, you're not going to get caught. It's not designed, it's not a practical, if I was going to make a law to catch adulterers, this is not a practical law. I'll catch no one with this law. Four witnesses, and they all have all the testimonies must be exactly the same. And if not, they're punished for false witness. It is designed for its deterrent effect. The purpose of this law is just to deter you from committing adultery. If I said, for example, that anyone who rides a unicorn will be hung, drawn, and quartered. It's a horrific hung, drawn, and quartered. It's very horrific. But riding a unicorn, they don't exist. But I bet it'll make you think twice about drawing a picture of a unicorn. You think, does this count? Wait, it doesn't, but it'll make you think twice. And it's purely, that's its function, it's preventative. And I'll show you why, and I'll go forward into showing why the Islam's focus on punishment is actually just preventative. And of course, as we know, fornication, or sex outside marriage, is prescribed not capital punishment, but corporal punishment. So it's not execution. But the reason why is because us human beings, we are based on families. Families are protective, commitment-based units. If a man sleeps with a woman, there must be commitment. The man must be ready to commit to that woman, and vice versa. He shouldn't be playing around with her heart. You know, scientists have discovered that basically, when sexual intercourse, your brain produces oxytocin, which is basically makes you love the person. So it tries to increase love. So in essence, the saying, making love, is literally true. So if you were to have sex with no commitment and no family and no long-term emotion, then isn't this going against our nature? Isn't this going against human nature to form long-term relationships and bonding via sexual intercourse? So this is the Islamic penal system. It actually advocates forgiveness. But I haven't finished with discussing the penal system. But I'll jump on next to another major issue, homosexuals. Does the Sharia kill homosexuals? Will homosexuals be massacred in an Islamic state? The answer is no. Actually, yes. The answer is no. The Islamic texts do not define or judge people by their sexual preferences. Islam doesn't discriminate against homosexuals because we don't discriminate homosexuals from any other human being. There is no word in the Quran or the Hadith for a person whose sexual preference is the same gender. It doesn't even discuss them as a group. It just talks about the crime, which is sodomy. It just talks about the crime, not about the person. In the Hadith, the Prophet Muhammad said, Allah forgives my people for the evil thoughts that occurs in their hearts. So basically, you're not held accountable for your sexual, for any desires you have in your heart. Allah will not hold you accountable for what you hold in your hearts in terms of your desires. So why should we now hate this race, some kind of like this kind of racial group called the homosexual? Did you know that once they were labeled and categorized, then discrimination began in the West? Before that, it was called sodomy. And they didn't have the European and ancient, and even ancient history, people didn't have a specific word for a person that basically sleeps with the same gender. It was only in recent times, they said, right, there's heterosexuals and homosexuals and bisexuals and so on. When they came up with a descriptive term, then homosexuals became discriminated. Then you're no longer just a human being that has sexual preferences, you're now a heterosexual or a homosexual. It's an artificial categorization, which Islam doesn't do, and hence Islam can't discriminate. Islam does not punish men for living together, and nor does it spy on them. So Islam, Sharia won't spy on what people do inside the privacy of their own homes. Islam doesn't prohibit men from holding hands in public or hugging. If you go to some of the Arabic countries in the world, men do that anyway. Even kissing, but we won't go there. Islam only prohibits public sexual intercourse. That's it. Ironically, even in this country, you can't have sex in public. So I don't know why Islam is singled out as hating on homosexuals. Islam will also punish people who are heterosexual, using that term, who commit public acts of intercourse. So again, as I said before, Islam only regulates the public square. Society is a living organism, and what you do in public affects people's perceptions, inclinations, and desires, even unconsciously. Now, the second criteria, I've dealt does Islam allow or not allow natural human fulfillment? I've dealt with the second criteria, and that second criteria is, does the Sharia show compassion? The Prophet Muhammad said in the Hadith, ward off the capital punishments, the hudud, from the Muslim as much as you can. If there is any possible way for the accused, let him go. For a judge to make a mistake in pardoning is better than him making a mistake in punishing. The Prophet Muhammad also said, forgive the capital offences amongst you. So find a way to forgive each other for even the capital offences, like murder, amongst each other before, and don't bring it to me, because if you bring it to me, I have to punish. So forgive it before. Don't come to me. Just try and forgive it amongst yourself. This is what the Prophet Muhammad is trying to encourage. And again, there was a man called Hazal who encouraged his friend Maiz to confess to adultery that he had committed. The Prophet Muhammad narrated that after the punishment of Maiz, he said, woe to you, O Hazal, if you had veiled him with your mantle, with your coat, basically, it would have been better for you. I.e., if you had hid his sin, if you had told him, if you had not encouraged him to go out in public, you know, that would have been better for you. I.e., don't try to get don't try to snitch, and don't try to, if you know a crime happens, which hasn't hurt anyone, like murder, for example. So if the crime hasn't hurt anyone, then keep it to yourself. Hopefully God will forgive you, or will forgive your friend. And this is what the Prophet Muhammad is saying. So we don't want Islam, it almost seems like he doesn't want to punish. He doesn't want to implement these punishments. If these punishments have to be implemented, then the Sharia has failed. That's basically the case. It's failed to deter you from committing that crime. So basically, the Sharia allows forgiveness for crimes. The Sharia sets almost absurdly high standards of evidence for prosecution of capital offences, while allowing their preventive significance to regulate and deter people. Sharia encourages personal forgiveness. The Sharia encourages hiding one's crimes if it did not involve physical harm, as I said. So there's no concept of a police state in Islam where you put cameras up everywhere, unlike perhaps the country we might be living in. Sharia takes into account mitigating circumstances, like crimes committed out of poverty, which cannot be punished, like theft, But it does not allow the rich to get away with committing a crime. We know the story of a noblewoman from the tribe of Makhzum who stole at the time of the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ, and people wanted to intercede on her behalf because she was a rich noblewoman, a noble person. And the Prophet Muhammad became angry and said, "Do you intercede concerning a right set by God? Those who came before you were destroyed because if the rich committed a crime or stole, they would let him off. But if a lowly person stole, they would carry out the punishment. By God, if Fatima bint Muhammad, which was his daughter, if my daughter was to commit a crime, I would cut off her hand as well." So we are impartial. Islamic justice is impartial. In liberalism, money affords leverage. Due to the unfair system of defense representation, the rich can hire the best lawyers. Presumably, it is done because the better the law you get, the better result in court you get. But how is that fair and just? Isn't justice meant to give you one verdict? Why should having a good lawyer affect the result or not? Why? Liberalism, in the name of impartiality and equality, doesn't forgive, and it applies its laws on those people who may not even believe in them. Like, for example, in France, the banning of hijab in schools. In Switzerland, the banning of minarets and so on. That's not fair. Why must we be faced with such a law? But hey, it's liberalism. Somehow it makes sense to them. So Islam doesn't believe, as I said, in one law for all. It says that you do believe in different beliefs. That's fine. Then you have your own religious laws. We're not going to impose our law system on you. And there are two, and there are some, my final points. Now, to wrap up, I have some final points. These are things that people don't ask, but I want to mention it because you need to hear this. Islam is humane to the poor. Islam bans interest, advocates currency based on gold and silver, not artificial printed paper. It bans monopolies and hoarding of wealth. It encourages charity, investment, charitable lending, spending, and has a rich tax, which we call zakat, which must go towards 8 categories. And you should hear these categories, they're very interesting. Those living in absolute poverty. Those who cannot meet their basic needs. The zakat collectors themselves doing their job. People who are non-Muslims to aid reconciliation. People who are attempting to free from slavery and bondage. So basically, if there's a slave, you basically buy them and liberate them. Those who have incurred overwhelming debts while attempting to satisfy their basic needs. Those working for an Islamic cause, we call fi sabilillah, and the travellers in need. So when you travel and you run out of money and you can't get back to your house, whatever, or your home, then you're entitled to zakat. These are the 8 categories of people entitled to the zakat money. And Islam is humane to the weak. It grants justice to the weak, the common people who are not people of influence or power, like me and you. This is why Islam is anti-tyrannical and anti-democratic. And I'll tell you why. James Madison, an American founding father, he said, "A pure democracy can admit no cure to the mischiefs of faction. A common passion or interest will be felt by the majority, and there is nothing to check the inducements to sacrifice the weaker party. Hence it is that democracies have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths." And the Quran says, "O you who believe, stand out firmly for justice as witnesses to God, even against yourselves. All your parents, all your kin, and whether it be rich or poor, for Allah can best protect both. Follow not your lusts of your hearts, lest these swerve. And if you distort justice or decline to do justice, God is acquainted with all that you do." And the Quran also says, "If you obey the majority of people on earth, they will divert you from the path of God. They follow only conjecture and they only guess." Islam, we don't follow majorities because that means oppression of the minority. Look at Switzerland, majority voted for banning minarets. So much for rights. And Islam, we don't allow the rule of the minority or the rule of a dictatorship. The caliph in Islam, who is elected by the people, must and has to implement the Sharia whether he likes it or not. And there is no negotiation. And I will conclude with the saying of Umar bin Sa'd al-Ansari, a companion of the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ. "Islam will remain strong so long as the Islamic ruling is strong. The strength of Islamic ruling neither comes from flogging with the whip or killing with the sword, but from ruling with justice and holding fast to the truth." In conclusion, I would posit that liberalism is inhumane. Communism, which I haven't discussed much, is inhumane. But Islam is humane and compassionate. And humans are capable of goodness and bad. But Islam tries to eliminate the cause of bad and encourage the sources of good in human behavior. Thank you.
I just want to thank the speaker for enlightening us on the topic and really opening up to the floor now. You can ask any question you want. The question and answer session will last for 15 minutes, so please do raise your hands and ask any question you want. I think papers are also going to be passed around, so if you don't want to ask by voice, then just write your questions down and pass the papers forward. I'll be more than happy to read it out to the speaker. Anyone have any questions? Don't be shy. Put your hands up and ask the questions.
The polygamy first. Why is it allowed? I think this is an interesting question. You know, scientists have looked at something in different species of animals. It's called sexual dimorphism, which is basically the differences in the apparent look and physique of sexes within any particular species. And they've noted that the greater the sexual dimorphism, the greater the difference between the male, the appearance of the male and the female, the more the tendency towards polygamous relationships than monogamous relationships. So, for example, swans, who the male and female virtually resemble each other identically, they're monogamous. But other species, like, for example, roosters and chickens, for example, in one rooster with many chickens, that it's a kind of polygamous relationship because obviously the rooster looks different from the chickens. So it is, in essence, men and women, we look different, and so in some cases, we follow this natural law of all creatures, whereby we have tendencies to polygamy as well. But there are conditions that come along with that. In essence, because there is one male to every female generally, and there might be a few extra females and so on, but because there is one male to every female, generally, monogamy is the prescribed method that most Muslims follow, that 99% of Muslims will follow. But if in case of war or due to various issues or conditions, for example, a husband dying, there are widows and there are women who basically have kids and no one to support them, that rather than leave them to fend for their own, Islam has allowed a man to take over protection and responsibility of additional women to his wife. Now, obviously, he'll need to have the financial resources to accommodate two women and treat them both equally. Two houses to house them, which most of us can't get and will probably never get. And of course, I mean, treating two wives equally, this is a very, very big task, since that some men seem to have a problem treating one wife equally to their rights and responsibilities. So in essence, it's a very high standard. And in essence, it can only be satisfied by people who are very rich and have loads of properties and lots of wealth, that they could look after the women who are widows and divorcees. And the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ married women who were, most of the women he married were people who were divorcees and war widows. So this is basically the conditions around polygamy. Most men will probably not do it and can't do it, even though when they're young they like to joke with each other that they will, but they never will. Once they discover how demanding being responsible for one person is, they generally change their mind. So that's basically, in a nutshell, the conditions for polygamy.
Any other questions?
You mentioned the Caliph Umar, but you didn't mention anything about the Pact of Umar or any mention of Dhimmi.
Sure. The Pact of Umar, what do you want me to discuss about the Pact of Umar?
We'll start with the fact that non-Muslims can't carry weapons, or that they can't ride on donkeys unless they're riding side saddle, or the fact.
All right, I know you're referring to the, historians have discovered there are two pacts of Umar. And there's a great treatise by a Palestinian Christian writer, I forget his name, who actually discussed this in depth. The first pact of Umar is very simple, and it gives Christians full equal rights. It's not controversial at all whatsoever. The second pact of Umar, they call it the second pact of Umar, is a forgery and a fake, which came much, much later at a time where Arab nationalism was basically dominating, or kind of Arab tribalism was dominating the Umayyad caliphates, which Muslims later on rebelled against and changed because it was unequal and unfair. So during that time, non-Muslims were given a bit more of a raw deal, and this was because the people in power were going outside of the remit of Islam. And they were basically, at that time, if you were a Persian or a Turk and you wanted to become a Muslim, they didn't treat you as Muslims, because only Arabs would be Muslim, and they wanted to get your zakat tax as well as your zakat tax as well as your jizya tax, which is the citizenship tax as well. So people became Muslim in spite of a corrupt government at that time. And then the Abbasids caused a revolution with Persians leading at the front and changed this corrupt system and restored a more equal-based system back to its Islamic roots. Of course, not every Abbasid caliph was obviously spotless, but the fact that you had a lot of revolutions and uprisings in early Islam shows that people believed in Islam and were not going to take oppression from their leader. And in Islam, you're encouraged to change your leader as soon as he deviates from ruling by the Book of God, which a lot of these caliphs unfortunately did.
Any more questions?
Are there any books or resources that you suggest for research on topics that you mentioned?
Well, there's quite a lot of books. Well, I mean, if you the variety of books. If you want a book on just state ruling, there's Imam Muwardi's Ahkam al-Sultaniya, which is the, I think, was it the rules of governing in Islam. That's a good book. Ibn Khaldun's Al-Muqaddima is a very good book. The Introduction to History is a very good book. The grandfather of sociology, considered by many. That's a very good book to look at. He studies it from a holistic sense and looks at different societies. He condemns various rulings, various governments at his time of being not Islamic and not acting according to Islam. And this was in the 14th century. And he exposed how there was the corruption which was going against Islam, and how this was a detriment to Islam and the Muslims. And that as Muslims, we are most successful when we are following Islam, we're implementing Islam, and we are less successful when we are treating people unequally and unjustly. So there's a variety of books, but inshallah, I'll probably send maybe a list of them to the Emir, and you can send them out to people, just a reading list for you to look after.
Any other questions?
Yeah, you mentioned that when Muslims would take over Christians and things, they are allowed to have their own law, follow the Christian law. Say if Sharia law came into this country, would it disregard British law? Or does it only allow rights for religious laws and not non-religious laws?
Sure, well, okay, I mean, take on Sharia in this country, I mean, because... because the people, okay, let's say if tomorrow 80% convert to Islam or something like this, then or whatever, then fine, we could talk about discussing Sharia. For those people who are not who were not Muslims, they are not forced to fast, they're not forced to pray like us. They can, I mean, you found that in a time of in the 10th century, Christian areas, they were rearing pigs underneath a Muslim state, Islamic state. You had pig pens in the Christian areas where they would eat bacon and things like this, which Christians are allowed to eat and we're not. And they had alcohol and they were consuming alcohol in their own areas, but obviously not in the Muslim areas. So it would be basically like this, that they would have their zones. I think that the best comparison in modern day world I could see is, I think maybe it's Indonesia or Malaysia, where basically in the time of Ramadan, Muslims aren't allowed to eat, but non-Muslims are allowed to eat, and that's the closest I can find to that kind of multicultural system that Islam envisioned. Other place would be possibly Saudi Arabia, with their zones where they allow Americans to come and exploit their oil, but they don't apply the Sharia on these to these peoples. The people in these little zones, They walk around exposed with shorts and everything like this, and they drink and they do whatever Americans do, and no Sharia is applied on them. And you know when people say, "Oh, these Muslims come to UK, they like if I go over there to their country and act the way I do." Well, you do anyway, yeah. But I could point to Saudi Arabia, they have compounds where the Sharia is not applied. Although one could argue that Sharia is not applied, even outside those compounds, but that's a different discussion.
The question then, we go back to...
Does Sharia have anything about international politics? Does it say anything
international
about
politics, how
to rule countries in an international level?
Sure. Basically... There are a few verses of the Quran which I brought for this, for that precise question. I knew it was going to come up. The Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, "And what is the matter with you that you fight not in the cause of Allah for the oppressed amongst men, women and children who say, 'Our Lord, take us out of this town of oppressive people and appoint for us from yourself a protector and appoint for us from yourself a helper.'" This, the Islamic international perspective would be that we would be against oppression wherever it is and to whoever it is done to. The verse of Quran doesn't say, "What is the matter of you that you fight not in the cause of Allah for the Muslim men, women, children?" It didn't say that. It says for men, women and children, generic, as in all men, women and children. Whoever is oppressed amongst men, women and children, we as Muslims must fight. But then the Quran also says, "Allah does not forbid you to deal justly and kindly with those who fought you not on the account of your religion and did not drive you out of your homes. Verily Allah loves those who deal with equity." So the Quran is commanding us that those people who don't fight you and don't kick you out of your homes and don't fight you because of your religion or for other reasons like material wealth or whatever, but these people that don't fight you, Allah does not forbid you from dealing kindly and justly with them. And you know, and Allah loves those who deal with equity. So this is our foreign policy right here. So those people who have designs in the Muslim world and want to take resources and want to attack and kill Muslims and occupy Muslim land as they've done in Israel and occupied Palestine, then our policy is very, very simple, that we will prohibit that and prevent that. And as I said, when people say, "Oh, you want to wipe Jews off the map or whatever," and I said, "No, you know, Jews can stay. They've been 1,400 years, Jews and Muslims have been living together harmoniously, as that Jewish historian mentioned. But the Zionists have to go." And there's a difference between Jews and Zionists. So this is basically the Islamic foreign policy. And it doesn't matter which country. If Rwanda was happening at a time of an Islamic state, we wouldn't wait, send a few soldiers, then retreat them and let people be massacred, or what happened in Srebrenica and Bosnia. We wouldn't do that. We'd go straight in there. If we had the means, we'd go straight in there and we'd help the poor and oppressed. Because in Islam, we view this as the best form of da'wah. If you display justice and you display care and compassion, this is the best way to convey your civilization's values and if you believe in them. And it's funny, the Western countries who claim they believe in human rights, but they support dictatorships. And they support dictatorships up and just to the point where they're about to fall, and then they change and say, "Oh yeah, we're against the Tunisian regime now." Yeah. Even though France and America and England have been supplying the Tunisian regime the anti-riot gear, bullets and things. And Libya had been the best mates with UK recently. And of course, Egypt was best friends with America and Israel, and they were supporting them until the point where they thought, "Oh, he's gonna go. Okay, yeah, we condemn tyranny. Oh, thanks. You know, very, very timely." So that was my answer.
Okay, a question
over
there.
Have you got any examples of any actual countries that follow Sharia to the degree that you described?
Unfortunately, not. Historically, obviously, there was many caliphates which were implementing the Sharia system. The Ottomans did for the longest period of time until they declined, and then they started to mix and match their law system with, I think, some foreign elements, and they just collapsed after World War I. So, and unfortunately, this discussion is mostly theoretical, but it has historical precedence, and hence I quote historians. To find my examples of civilization, I have to go back in history, which is it's a shame. Just like it's a shame that, for example, in the time of the caliphates, Muslims had a higher literacy rate than they do now, for example, in the same areas. It's strange. So for us to progress, we have to go back or whatever, at least back to our values, not necessarily back to the technology of that time. But we were forefront in technology, we were forefront in development, we were forefront economically and military and so on. And now we're not. And why is that? And if you look at our countries, it should be obvious. Our countries are secular regimes. Our countries, we're not following the Sharia. We think we are told the Sharia is outmoded and that you should follow democracy and liberalism, secularism, because it brings peace and prosperity to the world. But it doesn't. So now us Muslims are in the middle of a crossroads. Do we say, "Oh, well, let's try to reform Islam like the Christians did their belief and then become secular and then make the same mistakes again?" Or do we have trust and confidence in our belief and actually strive to implement it in our regimes and cause a positive change whereby instead of me needing to give this lecture here today, we can just point to the news and say, "That's our state, there you'll see Islam, full stop, here's a free ticket, whatever. You know, please visit."
So we have a question there and the last question here.
For example, in the situation when a Muslim man lives in a non-Muslim country,
yeah,
and the law system of this country contradicts to Sharia, which should prevail for him? Is he revealed from his some duties, for example?
From what I know, the Sharia ruling on this is if you go to a foreign country or you live in a foreign country and you make an agreement, i.e. to live in that country, then you must respect the rules and laws of that country. However, if they command you to do something against your belief or your good conscience, then you can't do it. So if they force you to eat pork or join the army and kill people, innocent people, you can't do it, you can't obey, you have to disobey. And the Quran talks about people who, on their judgment, will say to God, like, you know, I'm sorry, I did all these bad things. I it was people around me. And Allah will say back to them, wasn't the earth big enough for you to migrate? So if you really are oppressed and they're making you go against your religion, then the last thing to do is migrate and go to a place where at least you won't be forced to do things against your belief.
Okay, so we have a question again.
Hi. How is it just to allow sin within the privacy of your own home?
Okay. How is it just to allow sin in the privacy of your own home? Well, it's very simple. We have free will. The whole point of this exercise, so to speak, of us existing, is to make a choice. So we can choose to worship God or not. The Prophet Muhammad is described as a mercy to mankind. He was sent as a mercy, i.e., the system that he brought is to help us be good people. And this is God's mercy. So God is doing a favor for us. So he's going to help us condition our environment so that we don't make mistakes, we don't do bad things or self-destructive modes of behavior or mutually destructive modes of behavior. But the Sharia cannot compel you to be a good person. Because if the Sharia forces you on gunpoint to be a good person, then there's no free will. And where is your accountability before God? What was the point of this, of creating us in the first place, if we can't exercise our free will? But at the same time, you can't let people go out in public and, you know, through what we call, you know, unconscious influence each other into bad things. So what Islam does is very simple. In the public, the Sharia is going to help you be a better person by preventing women from being sexually exploited in public, preventing interest, concentration of wealth, property, all these things. In private, it's between you and God, and this is your test. Now, are you a hypocrite, or are you a true person, a man of ethics, belief, morality, and faith? This is the test, is in your own home. See, so this Sharia is meant to help us, but it's not going to compel us to be good people.
Does that not leave people vulnerable?
Well, vulnerable to yourself, I suppose. Or in a way, we're vulnerable from what we believe is, shaitan, the wisdom of shaitan, the obviously trying to corrupt us. But as I said, we're humans, right? We're always vulnerable to many things. But the Sharia is trying to help us. It's not going to make us invulnerable to committing immorality, because that denies free will. We have free will means you have to have a choice to do good or do bad. In the public society, society is not going to corrupt your youth, it's not going to corrupt yourself. This is what the Sharia is here to do, is to prevent this corruption coming from outside. Inside your house, it's your choice. And that's between you and God. And this is the real test. So, inshallah, the Sharia is hoped that by making you a good person outside your house, you'll be a good person inside your house. But if you still insist on being a bad person, then you must be truly a bad person to go against society even and do bad things even in your own house. So the Sharia is here to help us, but it can't compel you to be a good person.
Okay, that was the final question. I just want to thank the speaker again. Thank you very much. I'm sure many of you have any more questions, but the speaker will be around for 5 or 10 minutes, and you can speak to him outside. I just want to remind you again that the feedback forms are on your tables in front of you, so please do fill them in. And also outside, we have hot snacks as well as literature. So